Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Up the middle and through. Kipnis will score. Lindor's had a big turn. And now he's almost caught in between, but he will go back to first base. Indians take the lead. The 0-1. Lindor a little number.
Gonna be tough.
Bregman, bare hand grab. It doesn't come up with him. And the Indians are going to benefit for the second time on this homestand on an identical play. A shortstop goes for the bare hand grab, whiffs, and instead of giving up one, they give up two.
But he has thrown a boatload of pitches.
Oh, Almonte down the line, headed for the corner. Ramirez scores. Here comes Lonnie right on his heels. And he'll score without a throw, and it's a two-run triple for Abraham Almonte and an 8-3 Cleveland lead.
The 1-1, swinging a line drive down the left field line toward the corner, and that is a fair ball. It'll be a ground rule double, RBI, two-out double for Iglesias, and the Tigers take a 4-3 lead in the seventh. Swinging a line drive, base hit up the right center field. Gathett might tie the game. Abreu around second. He's being waved around third. Kinsler will not be able to relay to the plate. How about that?
Holy mackerel.
Double by Morneau, 4-4 game. 1-1. Swinging a ground ball up the middle and into center field, and the Sox will take the lead. The 1-2. Check swing. Went too far, and Collins strikes out. Tigers take the lead to the bottom of the eighth, but they cannot hang on, and the Sox take the series.
Great move by the New York Mets. They could obviously use some pop, a big bat. Tim Tebow swings a big bat. Is it a long shot that he would make it to the big leagues? It is a long shot, but I do give him a legit shot, just as the Mets are giving him a legit shot to start in the instructional league, go to winter ball, play double A, and just see if he could settle in, get more comfortable with the speed of the game that he has not played since he was a junior in high school. I believe he can become a serviceable left fielder for the New York Mets.
Playing a real good football team, that's a real challenge. We have weapons. We got guys we can throw the ball to. We got a quarterback that's been around and played. There are a lot of things, you know, that I like about our entire team. But we also got to play the game as well. You know, I mean, you can talk about it all you want, but let's see how well we play. Let's see how good we are.
Every year you go out and play, you want to start the season fast. You want to start the game fast, especially on the road. And this year is no different. We're looking forward to the opportunity to go out and play. We're excited about it. You know, it's obviously a unique challenge going and playing a good football team at their place. I've got to go and start the season off the right way.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Oh, yes, indeed. Can you feel it getting ready? Football is basically here. Welcome into this edition of the Extravaganza. Jim Cushland here with you temporarily, of course. We're having a little technical snafu connecting to Bob's part of the studio, but we'll hope to have those bugs worked out in just a little bit. You heard a lot in that montage right there. We'll get to all those things as we go over the course of the show, but the final things you heard are, quite frankly, the most important right now. You heard from Jim Caldwell and Matthew Stafford wanting to see go out there and just see how good they are, as the Detroit Lions will open the season Sunday against the Colts in Indy, and lots of other football, of course, as it's NFL's opening weekend. And it all starts actually tonight. Rematch of the Super Bowl, Broncos and Panthers. We'll have it for you, courtesy of our friends at Westwood One. 7:45, the pregame time for that. So it's really time to start talking about actual on-the-field NFL stories. And we're going to get some previews of Week 1, get some picks over the course of the next couple days, today and tomorrow, and all that good stuff. And we want to talk some Lions right now as they get ready for that opening game in Indianapolis on Sunday. It'll be
Actually, it'll be a 2:30 pregame time right here on the ticket for that 4:15 or so kickoff from Indy. And to help us talk all things Detroit Lions here on the ticket, we welcome in. He's the beat writer for the Detroit Lions for the Detroit News. He is Justin Rogers back on the show with us. Hi, Justin. How you doing?
It seems like Matthew Stafford out-cliched himself in that montage.
I know,
really,
right?
A unique challenge. I mean, at this point, how many road games have you had? It's not really that unique at this point, Matthew.
Yeah, for Matthew Stafford, no. I'm sure there's a couple rookies on the team who this is new to, but Stafford is not. So good catch on the cliche. He must have taken that Bull Durham lesson right there. But it's going to be an interesting opener, I would think, for the Detroit Lions. And you know, we've kind of talked about this in previous times we've had you on, Justin, about some of the things in the schedule. But just starting off, it's at least nice that we have football that actually counts. We're done with the preseason. Rosters are what they are. And the Lions go on the road to open the season. It's a tough team in Indy. They didn't do as well last year, but they still have Andrew Luck. And I'm a Browns fan, so I know one thing is that you need a quarterback to, in theory, win some games. And the Colts still have one in Andrew Luck. So a good opening test, I would imagine, for the Detroit Lions.
Oh, yeah. I think when Luck is healthy, you know, I think he's right in that conversation of top five, top seven quarterbacks in the NFL. Has everything you'd want in terms of prototype. He's got the big arm. He's fairly accurate. He's mobile. He's got that Roethlisberger build, so he's tough to bring down. You know, Andrew Luck's a special talent, and the Colts really fell apart. And I know he was struggling early last season before he missed some time, but he was banged up before that. It was banged up after that. You know, his style of play isn't necessarily conducive to staying healthy. And you know, there are reports going into this one he's not healthy, that the shoulder's still frayed. It's not causing him any problems, per se, physically at this point, but he's at a greater risk of injury, and I think he's going to have to play his style of game a little bit differently, and that'll be interesting to see how it will. You know, how safe will he be? How much will he scramble? How much is he going to be willing to take a hit, especially early in the game? And how much can his offensive line protect him? Because that's certainly been an issue there for the last couple of years.
Well, and this gets to one of the things about the Lions. We know some of the changes, but some of the things that have remained the same on that front seven for the Lions. Do you see them wanting to blitz more to try to get that extra pressure on Luck, or is there a different avenue they might go?
You know, I think you'll see some blitzing. Terrell Austin definitely mixed in more as the season went on last year, and they found a lot of success with it. But, you know, the front four itself is pretty good, and they don't need to take away a defender from the defensive backfield that often to do it, especially when you look at the success of the Colts offensive line, even in the preseason. You know, Luck in that third preseason game, the dress rehearsal, if you will, took a beating in just a quarter. I believe he got sacked three times, got hit several more. And so it's just not a good front, you know, and the Lions are coming in with, that's probably their deepest unit is that front four. They can rotate through eight or nine guys up there, all who are capable pass rushers. And so I don't know if you'll see a lot of blitzing. You'll definitely see some, but I'm not sure the Lions are going to need a whole lot of that.
We're talking with Justin Rogers. He's the beat writer for the Detroit Lions for the Detroit News, as we're just a couple days away from the Lions opening the season at Indianapolis. 2:30 pregame time, by the way, coming up on Sunday. Season itself opens tonight. Carolina and Denver, courtesy of our friends at Westwood One, will have it for you. 7:45 pregame time right here on the ticket as the NFL is back, and that's what we're talking about to start off here today. Since we last had you on, we obviously had the final round of roster cuts in the final preseason game. Obviously not going to ask you anything about the final preseason game. Nobody really played, but is there anything of note from the final round of cuts and the final 53-man roster that we should know?
Yeah, I mean, there was some surprises on there, and as there always are, and I think probably a little bit more so with a new general manager. You know, there was an undrafted rookie, cornerback Darius Barnes. No one in my room, in the media room, saw this guy making the roster. He just was one of those guys that kind of blended into the crowd. There's undrafted rookies every year that stick around to the final roster cut, but nobody sees him as having a chance. He made the roster, and I asked Darius Slay, what have I been missing about this guy? He said he's got the quickest first step of any cornerback in the room. He recognizes routes quickly, and he can drive on the ball. The Lions think maybe he could be a nickelback backing up Quandre Diggs. The defensive line, where there was a lot of interesting cuts, Caron Reed, just after 2 years, is out. Another Martin Mayhew draft pick, Alex Carter, the cornerback, is out. And it looks like the Lions are going young, and it also looks like they're going very much with Bob Quinn's guys going forward.
How about the quarterback situation? It became Dan Orlovsky was named as the backup. Jake Rudock's still around with the team, but most likely on a practice squad. How did we get to this point? Because I was kind of thinking it was Rudock who was looking better during much of preseason.
Yeah, Rudock did look better for much of the preseason, but he also was facing a lesser tier of defenders. You know, he was coming out there with a third stringers, and he was going against third string defenders who are probably almost all of them are out of the NFL right now. Maybe a few are still sticking around on practice squads. Orlovsky was at least going against some level of either low level starters, rotational guys, or, you know, backups that are still in the league right now. So if you look at their numbers side by side, they're fairly identical. Obviously, Orlovsky made two critical mistakes. Rudock made one critical mistake with interceptions. Rudock offers a little bit more with his feet, but I don't know how much that plays against first-tier defenders. So there's more development to be done. I never expected him to overtake Orlovsky for the backup job. You know, the Lions coaching staff, the general manager is still very comfortable having a veteran in there, not just because of what he offers in the field, but what he offers in the locker room, what he offers in the film room, what he offers on game day and the sideline. You know, they took a risk. It was a calculated risk. I think they looked around the league, saw what other teams were doing. They let Rudock, they exposed him to waivers. He cleared, and now he's back. And the development will continue just as it would if he's the third quarterback on the roster. His salary is going to be a little bit lower, but guess what? He doesn't take up a roster spot that would have been absolutely wasted had he been on the roster. There's a finite number of roster spots. There are 53, and you need all of them, especially as the injuries start mounting up. So to have Rudock still on the roster but not counting against the roster is very beneficial.
And especially taking that last point into account, barring injury to, say, Matthew Stafford, that moves everybody up the food chain, is there any scenario you can envision in the 2016 season where this dynamic would be reversed?
Yeah, well, I don't know if Rudock's going to jump Orlovsky at any point in the 2016 season, but I guess if you're asking me to envision any crazy scenario, what would happen, I guess, would be Stafford going out for the year. They're turning to Orlovsky and promoting Rudock from the practice squad to be the backup, and then Orlovsky gets hurt, you know, maybe in a game, and Rudock steps in and plays extraordinarily well in this window of opportunity and you know, usurps Orlovsky for that backup role. I mean, that's a lot of contingencies to happen, a lot of injuries to happen, which no fan should ever be wishing for. So I think at the end of the day, you're looking at a guy that's going to develop all season. And barring what the Lions are able to do in the draft in 2017 or in free agency 2017, you know, you're probably looking at a kid that will be the backup to Matthew Stafford next season.
We're talking with Justin Rogers. He is the beat writer for the Detroit Lions for the Detroit News, getting you ready for the opening weekend of the NFL. Lions, they're in Indianapolis for this one. Lots of talk I heard off and on over the course of the training camp and preseason about exactly how the Lions will be using their running back and how much specifically you're going to end up using somebody like Amir Abdullah. What do you see the overall game plan from a team whose roster construction still tells me this is, in theory, a pass-first offense with complimentary run? How do you see Amir Abdullah's role overall shaking out?
You know, Caldwell came out yesterday and said he's not going to be a guy that runs it 30 times a game. Well, yeah, no kidding. Nobody runs it 30 times a game anymore. He might. There's very few running backs in this league that average 20 carries a game. So I look at Abdullah and I look at what he did last year, and he averaged about 10 carries a game. That's going up. You know, it's probably going to be on a weekly basis, just depending on the game plan and the scoring situation, it'll probably range between 12 and 20 carries a game. I don't think he's going to top 20 too often, but when you factor in what he contributes in the passing game with some targets there, you know, that's a pretty healthy workload. And then the Lions are going to kind of mix and match with their other three guys based on, you know, the opponent's situation. Zach Zenner is going to kind of start off in that power back role. Theo Riddick, I don't think, is still going to carry the ball a whole lot, but he's obviously a very valuable wide receiver in the system. The real wild card is Dwayne Washington. Obviously had a phenomenal preseason, had some really big plays that carries over from his college scouting report. So the guy that had 8 50-plus yard touchdowns while in college, he just has that big play potential. Not only that, he's a big-bodied guy. You know, he's 6'2". He looks like a linebacker. He's 6'2", 225 in that ballpark. So how much of the line is going to play him early? I don't know. But he has that big playability. He has that frame that could handle third downs, and if he could get those limited opportunities and makes the most of them, I could see him climbing up the depth chart and becoming the number two back to Abdullah.
Justin Rogers of the Detroit News, Lions beat writer, joining us here on the Extravaganza as we get you ready for NFL weekend so far. And the Lions, of course, in Indianapolis. What's the situation right now with Eric Ebron? He just returned to practice basically the other day. And obviously the Lions, due to injuries mostly, have been thin at tight end all camp and preseason. What do you see his status at this point going forward?
you know, I can't say that he's 100%, but the fact that he practiced fully yesterday is a really good sign. And it pretty much suggests at this point in the week that he's going to be active for that game. Is he going to play 60, 80% of the snaps? I don't know. I can't say. Lions have picked up a couple other tight ends. They've got four on the roster now. They added a blocking tight end from the Bears this week off waivers. You know, I think they're going to mix and match some of their young guys, Orson Charles and Cole Wick, but Ebron is going to be good enough to go. I think you'll see plenty of them out there against Indianapolis. I just don't know if you're going to see 100% full go Eric Ebron in week one.
Fair enough on that one. And that's kind of what I expected, essentially, at this point. I mean, you've missed that much of camp. I mean, what was it? The first preseason game, Justin, if I'm not mistaken, is what he went out injured, correct?
Yeah, week before, actually.
They
had a mock game. Yeah, they had a mock game, basically a scrimmage for fans at Ford Field. There was no real tackling in that game. So, yeah, he missed the entire preseason. He essentially missed all of training camp outside of a week and a half. So, you know, he's going to be rusty, but his athleticism plays, you know, every day of the week. It's just a matter of, you know, knocking off the rust, showing that he can take a tackle. This is an ankle injury, you know, based on the length of time he's been out. I'm sure it was a high ankle sprain. I'm not, you know, able to confirm that, but that just meets the timetable of what we saw. So, you know, it'll take away a little bit of his speed if it's lingering, but everything else should be good to go.
Joined by Justin Rogers of the Detroit News. He is the Lions beat writer for the Detroit News, getting ready for opening weekend in the NFL. And more good news, possibly. It looks like I fixed the little bugs connecting to a Bob's part of the studio. Let's see if a Bob. Bob, you there?
Hey, it's nice to be a guest.
Yay!
On the show.
Hey, there we go.
No, you guys are doing a great job. I'm sitting here listening and enjoying it. And, Justin, thanks for the time, obviously. I know you guys have talked about a few positions, but I just want to talk about what you wrote about for this preview of this season and game number one, and that's changing the culture, that Bob Quinn's job is to change the culture of one of the most – well, I think the way you worded it, least successful organizations. I was going to phrase it the most losing organizations in sports, but I guess yours is a little better. They have not been successful, and there has been a culture of defeatism. There has been a culture of you know, this is just the way the Lions are. It's the Lions' way. A lot of people said that. I mean, literally with everything, excuse me, everything that the Lions do, if the fans don't like it, they say it's just the Lions being the Lions. For example, when those who like Jake Rudock found out that they were keeping Orlovsky as the backup quarterback instead of Rudock, it was just more Lions being Lions. What a stupid idea that was. So there is a kind of a culture of defeatism there. Let's talk about what you wrote about today, Justin, and that is the culture being changed by the GM.
I filed that Tuesday. I had no idea it went up on the web, so you're breaking some news for me right there.
But, no, I mean, literally 12:45 this afternoon, and I always check Detroit News. I'm not saying that because you're on right now, but I check Free Press, too. I mean, I do my homework, and I do M Live and all that
that's
stuff.
That's it. The phone call's over.
Yeah, your former stomping grounds. So anyway, yeah, this came up early this afternoon.
Sure, yeah. So, listen, every general manager or new coach that comes into an organization is going to look to install cultural changes to, you know, transform a franchise into a winning one. And, you know, that's a steep challenge in Detroit. It just is. This team has stunk for decades now. And, you know, Matt Millen came in and tried to change the culture, and all the coaches he brought in tried to change the culture. Martin Mayhew tried to change the culture, and it hasn't worked. And, yeah, they took a little bit of a few positive steps with Mayhew. And so now Quinn comes in, and he's trying to do more, and he's bringing ideas from the Patriots organization, obviously the pinnacle of success in the NFL. You know, some of them are small things. They're under-the-radar things, but the things where he wants, as he described it, to make the workplace an appealing place for players to be. He wants them to enjoy coming to work. He's going to want them to come and stay at work a little longer. He wants them to build chemistry on and off the field because – in this sport, chemistry is important. You know, it's not just important at the offensive line. You know, it matters when teammates genuinely like each other. We talked to Chris Spielman earlier this offseason, and he said that was the thing about that 1991 team, that team that won the one playoff game, the Lions won, and fell a game short of the Super Bowl. He goes, those guys just loved hanging out with each other. Their families hung out. They would go to each other's houses and have board game nights, which, you know, just sounds weird for a bunch of NFL players sitting around playing Pictionary, but I mean, that's just the camaraderie that that group had. So Quinn's trying to instill that. And then you go to the bigger picture things. He's reworked the weight room, brought in a new weight trainer. He's hired a dietitian. And I can tell you, like, just looking around the locker room, these guys are in so much better shape. I'm talking top of the roster to the bottom of the roster. Guys like Haloti Ngata, who's been in the league forever, is, you know, much skinnier than he was last year. And listen, that skinny's relative here when you're talking about a 330-pound man. But these guys are in great shape, and they hope that that carries over season to season to season and starts building this winning culture. But at the end of the day, you still got to bring in the right players. Quinn's job is going to be able to draft well, to sign the right free agents, and you can't do all that in one season. But you know, he started that this year with 10 draft picks, 8 of which made the roster, and then obviously Rudock on the practice squad.
Yeah, and you know, you can't do all of the things you just described really to a really, really deep level in 1 year either. Changing the culture. I mean, you know, a losing culture isn't built in a year, and it's not fixed in a year either. But those are some great steps. From what you know, and I don't know how much you've talked to Bob Quinn about these changes and the kind of stuff he's trying to implement, is this Bob Quinn creativity, or is this Bob Quinn bringing the Patriot way? Is this something that he's just bringing it the way the Patriots do it to Detroit?
Well, it's a large part of that. It really is. But he also brought in other guys who, yeah, maybe started with the Patriots. You talk about your Kyle O'Briens, you know, who left New England and went to Kansas City and then went to Jacksonville, and he's brought in guys like that. He surrounded himself with, you know, people. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of them are from the Patriots, but who have grown and learned as professional football personnel men. And he's taking in their ideas too. He's very much an open door when it comes to ideas. You know, you hear the phrase "no stupid ideas." Like, he's always listening. Apparently, he's according to some of the players, he's consulted a lot of the top veterans on, you know, what they feel is lacking around the building or what's lacking on the roster. And, you know, it's not to say that he's taking all their ideas and implementing them immediately, but he's always trying to get a feel for the room as he's trying to incorporate new ideas to make this franchise better now and in the future.
Do you feel like, from the guys that you've talked to, and they can be coaches, front office guys, or players, are they buying in? Do they like the aesthetic changes around the facility? Do they like, you know, that you mentioned the strength coach and all the different things that, and the dietitians? Does it feel like everybody is really buying in? Like, hey, man, this is exactly what we needed.
You know, everybody is probably a bit of exaggeration. You know, there are guys that are no-frill guys. You know, I asked DeAndre Levy, and DeAndre Levy didn't care. He's like, listen, all these things are nice, but none of it matters on Sundays. And you have guys like that who have that attitude that, you know, I'm going to work hard and do my best regardless, and I don't need anything fancy. Then you have guys like Golden Tate. You know, this is a guy that came from a Super Bowl organization who was going through a very similar transformation when he arrived. The Seahawks were, they weren't a putrid organization. In fact, they had had a Super Bowl appearance several years before that, but, you know, they were.
Did we lose Justin there?
Looks like it. I'll see if I can reestablish
it just,
that.
Yeah, it just really cut out like right at the last second there. I thought maybe it's a little hiccup in the line and then suddenly silence for a few seconds here. So I don't know what happened to him. Tell you what. Why don't we take this opportunity? Jim, if you can finish reconnecting with him by the time I'm done talking, that's great. And I'm going to tell people about what else is exciting about this football season. The fact that it's about to start. Whether you're a Lions fan or you're a Colts fan or a Browns fan or anybody else, we've all been waiting for this to start. So let's go ahead and talk about fantasy football FanDuel style. You've probably been champing at the bit to put on a helmet and get into the game. I can't give you a helmet, but I can give you a clipboard and a pen, and you can kind of be your own GM or your own owner with FanDuel. That's right. FanDuel Fantasy Football is back, and it's here for everyday fans, too, with new contests starting every week. No busted seasons. You can't have your entire season ruined by an early season loss or an injury to one of your top draft picks. Just pick a contest, choose your team each week, and watch your score in real time. It is outstanding. Brand new this year, even more contest variety. You can try beginner contests for new players only. You know, if you don't want to get into one of those seasoned veteran battles with somebody who's been there a long time and you're just trying to figure it out, you go rookie against rookie. That's kind of cool. You can also go head-to-head with a friend and settle a score, or the 50-50 contest where the top half wins cash. Play in larger tournaments, smaller tournaments, doesn't matter. You can play for as little as a dollar. There are choices for every budget. Or you can dive into this week's Sunday Million contest, paying out $2 million. $200,000 to first place. That's what fantasy football is all about. Get all that fantasy football has to offer with FanDuel. Be sports rich. Try FanDuel right now and get up to $50 in free entries. New users who deposit will get 5 free entries to NFL 50-50 beginner contests valued at up to $50. You get 1 free entry a week for 5 weeks. The value of your free entry is based on the deposited amount. But get to FanDuel.com right now. Click the Join Now button and use my promo code France, F-R-A-N-T-Z. That's FanDuel.com. Promo code France, void where prohibited. Now, Jim, if you've got Justin back with us, let's go ahead and finish our conversation. It was a great opportunity to talk about FanDuel. Justin, are you still there, sir?
I am. I don't know when I got cut off there on my winded rant.
You were on an extended rant, and there was a blip, and it kind of sounded like it was going to be a call waiting thing, and you were going to bounce right back on, but then you never did for about 5 or 6 seconds after that. So, at any rate, you were in the midst of talking about, what guys have bought into it and what guys aren't. You know, some guys are talking about it really, between the lines on Sunday. None of this stuff matters. You mentioned DeAndre Levy talking about that. So, just go ahead and finish that thought on what the players seem to be feeling about the changing culture that Bob Quinn is trying to bring about to the franchise.
Yeah, I don't know if it got into it, but Golden Tate is an example of a player that's very excited and thinks it really matters. And he came from Seattle.
That's who you were talking about when you cut out there. So that's perfect.
Yeah, so Seattle's had all those changes and with John Schneider and Pete Carroll and it's transformed that organization to a winning organization. So Tate said everything that he saw that helped Seattle become successful are the type of things that Quinn's trying to implement in Detroit, and he is of the belief, and maybe Tate's just one of those guys that's more motivated by these changes, but he's of the belief that these are the things that make the difference.
Well, and you know what? I think it can be. I think there is such a thing as a culture of winning, and winning breeds winning. And if you do things first class, guess what? You want to play first class. It's why guys wear what they wear. You know, it's the kind of gear they want, the kind of gloves they want. When you look good, you feel good. And when you feel good, you tend to play good. You tend to perform better. So if they do all of these things in a first class way around the facility, around the organization from top to bottom, you feel first class. And guess what? It starts to permeate. It starts to, I think anyway, it starts to make you kind of play first class. So that is, and we lost him again, did you say? Okay, I was going to ask him for his prediction in this game, week one game. Tell you what, why don't you text us that one? That way we know we'll get it, and we won't lose you again, Justin. Obviously a bad connection there, and that's okay. It's time for a timeout anyway. So we'll get Justin Rogers' prediction for week number one with the Lions coming up. Also coming up after this bottom of the hour Sports Center, we want to get into the Tim Tebow story. He's not an Atlanta Brave like we talked about him possibly being yesterday. Instead, he's a New York Met, or at least he's a New York Met farmhand. What does this mean for Major League Baseball? What does it mean for Tim Tebow? Is it a publicity stunt, or is this a real legitimate opportunity to get into professional baseball for this very talented guy who hasn't found his niche in professional sports yet? So we'll talk a little bit about that. Top of the hour at 4:05. Jim, I'm sure you told everybody before we started, or before I got in, that Paul Keels will join us for his weekly Buckeye conversation. Talk about the record-setting offensive performance by the Bucks against BG in week number one. Talk about week number two to come. So all of that's still here. And, of course, we want you to be a part of the show at 866-240-1065 right here on the Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
By calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5, The Ticket.
Indeed. Thanks so much for being with us right here on the Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo sports leaders. So many interesting things to talk about. Kush, you did check back in with Justin Rogers after his phone crapped out on us, right?
Yes, I did.
And why don't you go ahead and tell everybody what Justin's predictions are for the Lions season record and for week number one against those Indianapolis Colts.
Right, because that's basically the only thing we didn't get to ask him there. 8-8, he says, for the season for his prediction, though he does have the Lions 24-20 over the Colts.
So 8-8, and I'm going to assume that's not good enough for a playoff spot in the NFC.
I don't think so. No.
And, you know, because we talked about it earlier, obviously when the terrible tragedy happened to Teddy Bridgewater, that it really, really takes the wind out of the sails of the Minnesota Vikings, and they can't just go to war with Sean Hill and expect to be, you know, maybe the second-best team in the division, which I think a lot of people feel like they are. Maybe some people might even have picked them if Bridgewater was healthy as being better than the Packers.
I was pre-Bridgewater's injury, I personally was debating that very thing.
Yeah. I mean, they won 11 games last year, and Bridgewater was still getting his feet wet, for crying out loud. He still didn't put up big numbers.
Right.
Not that you have to put up, 40 touchdown passes when you have Adrian Peterson, but At any rate, they might have been. And when he was out, and it was Sean Hill, I said, you know, this is a real big boost for the, you know, for the Lions as far as an opportunity to take a step up in the division. I think the Bears are going to be awful. I said maybe the Lions pass up Minnesota, but Minnesota pulled the, you know, pulled the trigger on that deal, first rounder and a fourth rounder to Philadelphia for Bradford. And not that Bradford is, you know, the second coming of Sammy Baugh, or I don't know why I just picked Sammy Baugh. I guess because of Sam Bradford, Sam B. But not that he's, you know, a Hall of Famer, but it is an experienced quarterback who can do some things and who might, if he stays within himself, working with Adrian Peterson, be just what the doctor ordered to keep Minnesota right back, you know, in that hunt for the NFC North crown. And that knocks, you know, obviously Detroit back down to probably third place. If you agree with me that Chicago is a fourth place team.
Yeah, I do agree that Chicago is a fourth place team. And yeah, having Sam Bradford, you're right. It's not like they suddenly have a Hall of Famer or anything in there, but he's probably going to be a little bit better, assuming he stays healthy, that is, himself, than Sean Hill. And since we're talking about Vikings, I think Fran Tarkenton would probably be the comparison you're looking for, possibly.
Oh, as far as Teddy mean?
Yeah. Especially considering we're talking about the Vikings after all. But whole point is it does open the door a little bit for the Lions. I would have probably had them at a very similar record that Justin has them at, especially pre-Bridgewater injury, because I figured the Vikings would have been a little stronger.
Yeah.
And debating them with the Packers, the only things that are solidified about that is, well, Bridgewater getting hurt doesn't affect the fact Chicago is the worst team in this division. And the only other thing it does is it pretty much cements, I think, the Packers as the division leader at this point going forward for this season. The real question for the Lions is, instead of 8-8 or 7-9, can they somehow turn that into a 9-7, maybe a little bit better, and be truly amongst that playoff race? Because even though we've seen at times in recent years where an 8-8 team will get in, usually they're division winners, not wild cards, by the way, I don't think that's going to be the case this year in the NFC. I mean, particularly when you think of, I got to figure two teams, Arizona and Seattle, for example, are coming out of the West. So that's only one wild card spot in the other three division titles in the NFC right there.
That's a great point. That is a very good point. And I'm not sure where the other one is going to come from, but we'll get into all of that when we do our full league predictions. But I want to take just a brief moment to do what Major League Baseball did today, and that is cut into the attention that is given to the NFL on their season opening night. I mean, this is a big deal. I was listening to another broadcaster today, doesn't matter who pointed out, you know how the NFL, Jim, and we've talked about this on this program, so it's not like there's new breaking news here. But we've talked about this, how the NFL does everything that it can to dominate the news cycle, the sports news cycle, from literally 12 months, you know, for 12 months a year. They move the draft. They expand the draft to 3 days. They move their draft up into a different month. They have their mini camps, and they have their free agency periods, and they have their trading periods, and they have them all spread out so that they are constantly in the center of attention, constantly eating away at the attention that other sports get. What Major League Baseball did today, in my opinion, was a shot right back at the NFL. You're starting your season tonight. You're starting your season with the Panthers and the Broncos, a rematch of the Super Bowl at Mile High. They're going to get their trophy. We're going to take some of the attention away from you today. Tim Tebow, one of the most well-recognized, if not well-respected, but recognized athletes in the world today. Make no mistake about that. Tim Tebow suddenly is announcing that he is signing with the New York Mets, the largest media market in the world, New York. One of the two largest franchises, the Mets, going to pick this larger-than-life personality up and bring him to their minor league system. They announce it in the morning in time for all the morning talk shows to daytime talk shows to get into this and spend their time talking about the New York Mets and talking about Tim Tebow instead of talking about, you know, Trevor Siemian starting his first game and the first Northwestern quarterback to start a game in the National Football League in, I don't know, ever maybe? So, you know, you're talking about, excuse me, what should be an NFL-dominated day because they're starting tonight and the trophy is presented, or not the trophy, but the rings and the banners hoisted and all that nonsense. It's going to happen a Mile High today. September 11th is 2 days away, and 3 days away technically, but after tonight's game. And, you know, of course, there's going to be so many things to talk about there with not only the first week matchups, but also the honoring of September 11th, the military patriotism, the whole Kaepernick story and how that ties in. And baseball just said, we are stealing your thunder. We are going to make sure that when the Mets announce this, it's going to be prime time for, you know, the daytime sports talk shows. And it's going to be one of the biggest markets, obviously, or the biggest market in Major League Baseball, signing Tim Tebow. So it was a master stroke, I think. And guess what else? I also think it is a great story. I am all in. It worked. I am all in. I've said this from the time I found out that Tebow has spent the last 9 months or so working out on his baseball skills, trying to recapture what he had when he was in high school, when he was an all-state player in Florida, when he hit 490 as a junior with four home runs and some 30 RBIs. I've said from the beginning, I hope this works. And I've challenged some of the haters who have said, Tim Tebow's just trading in on his celebrity to get an opportunity to play pro baseball that a ton of kids would never get. You know, young single-A guys who are trying to find a way to make people pay attention to them. Tebow got 46 scouts from 28 teams to come and watch him play simply because he's a celebrity. He's cheating the system. It's wrong, you know, for him to get this opportunity. And I have been just in the opposite camp. I want to see Tim Tebow succeed in the worst way. I want to see him go to the minors. Obviously, I don't want him to go to the majors. You know, he hasn't played baseball in 12 years. But his skill set looks like it absolutely can be built upon, and his baseball juices, if you will, revived and brought into an opportunity to see if he can hit minor league pitching. And if he can hit instructional league pitching, great. Put him in minor or in single A. And if he can hit single A pitching, super. Let's see what he can do. And let's take it until it, you know, the ride ends. And take it for what it is. A guy chasing a dream. Not a guy who's trying to be a sideshow phony. Not a guy who's trying to just command attention from sports writers and sports center and talk show hosts. Who's just trying to pull a fast one. Hey, I want everybody to still... That's not Tim Tebow's game. That's never been Tim Tebow's game. Trying to just draw attention for the sake of attention. He would try to draw attention for the sake of God, being the you know, devout Christian that he is, and he's constantly talking about God's graces. He wants to be known for that. But he just wants to be known for his ability, not for stunts. And the New York Mets were striking the right chord as far as I'm concerned today. Sandy Alderson insisted to all of the cynics out there, this is not for jersey sales and publicity. And I was really glad to see that he went to the Mets for that reason, too, because this isn't somebody that has a hard time getting attention. You know, if the Milwaukee Brewers would have offered him, if the, I don't know, Pittsburgh Pirates, I'm just trying to think of some of the smaller market teams that might not have a ton of money, might not have a lot of, you know, concession sales and that sort of thing. If they had signed him and said, yeah, we're going to bring him in and see what he's got, you might, if you're a cynic. You might be cynical enough to think, okay, this is just for publicity for that franchise. But these are the Mets. The Mets don't need that. This is not for publicity, Sandy Alderson said. They really want to see what he's got. Quote, while I and the organization are mindful of the novel nature of this situation, this decision was strictly driven by baseball, he said. This is a conference call with Tebow and his agent, Brody Van Wagenen, I guess is his name. Announcing the agreement that includes a $100,000 signing bonus for Tebow. This was not something that was driven by marketing considerations or anything of the sort. We are just extremely intrigued with the potential that Tim has. He has demonstrated over his athletic career that he is a tremendous athlete, has got character, a competitive spirit. Aside from the age, 29, this is a classic player development opportunity for us. As an organization, we're going to provide that development opportunity for Tim. End quote. And that is exactly how it should be. For anybody who still is opposed to this, I want to know on what basis. And were you as opposed to Michael Jordan back in 1994. Were you angry at the Chicago White Sox organization and Jerry Reinsdorf for giving him an opportunity to go down there and work this out and end up ultimately at Birmingham with the Barons, where, of course, he had a very forgettable career? Listen. I'm going to tell you this point blank. Tim Tebow, to my understanding, is 10 times the prospect in baseball that Michael Jordan ever was.
He's younger, too. I think Jordan was already 30 or something by the time he was doing that. I got to double check the age.
Not only that, but I mean just in terms of skill set. According to what I you know was reading, Michael Jordan was a very average high school baseball player. And he's 6'7" with that big long swing and those big long loping strides when he runs and no arm from the outfield. Michael Jordan had very, very limited skills in his set when he made this run. And still, while people just couldn't understand why he'd walk away from three straight championships and not try to make it four in a row, nobody really, you know, said this is a horrible, horrible idea from the White Sox standpoint. People just said, let it be. Whatever he wants to do, he does. Tim Tebow was an all-state player in high school. Far better. And when you look at him now at the age of 29 with the body he's got, the power he displayed at that workout, this is absolutely the right way to go about a player development opportunity. And that's exactly what Sandy Alderson and the Mets called it, and that's exactly the way Tim Tebow views it. He said he knows he's not going to go playing for the New York Mets anytime soon. He's going to see what it's like to ride the bus from cornfield to cornfield in the minor leagues, and he's willing to do it for a year or for a couple of years if it develops his skills and gets him in his early 30s an opportunity to play pro baseball, I mean to play Major League Baseball. What is wrong with chasing the dream? I absolutely love, and I mean love, this story. It is one of the few that has really grabbed me for quite some time. And I really want to see him make this. I'm not predicting that he will, but I will not predict against him either. I'm just going to be a patient bystander watching and waiting to see how this whole thing plays out for Tim Tebow. And I will be hoping, indeed maybe even praying. That's right, Tim Tebow, I'll fall to my knees and join you in prayer that he finds his way to a major league roster one day, because I think it would be one of the great stories. And being in our business, Jim Cushlin, this is what we look for, is great stories to talk about. And that's exactly what this is.
Exactly. And my piece on this, and I think I've kind of mentioned this to you when this has come up in these last couple weeks, is I don't see what the big deal from those who are being critical of it, because, and I was the one who at first started pointing out, Michael Jordan's time with Birmingham in 1994 when he tried this, especially when comparing stats. I mean, you look it up, they weren't very good. What's the harm in this? Send him to the, and it sounds like, incidentally, we've been talking maybe start single A. It does sound like after instructional league and then fall, and then the winter fall, Arizona fall league, stuff like that, that he's going to participate. It sounds like they're going to try double A, which is what they did with Jordan. Birmingham's a double A team. What's the harm in it? If he washes out, well, join the list of hundreds upon hundreds of minor leaguers who have done it.
Thousands who have washed out.
And
the
only, and I'm glad you point out the Mets thing too, because that's true with the attention, even when they're horrible, the attention the Mets get over a small market team. The only publicity factor that's in any way, shape, or form here is, if you're that minor league double-A team, I think it's Binghamton, but I have to double check what the Mets system looks like. You're chomping at the bit for this because you're going to get so much extra attention that you otherwise never would, and you're going to try to milk that for all it's worth. That's the only publicity part that I could see playing in here. But if you're Tebow and the rest of the Mets, what's the harm? If he flushes out, he flushes out. If he doesn't, he'll move up the system.
There's one negative on this, and I know we're getting to 3 o'clock here, so we got to get out. But one negative here that was pointed out by C.J. Nitkowski, the former Tiger, everybody, played for like 10 teams. But C.J. Nitkowski pointed something out that really does kind of make you question this. He tweeted earlier today at about noontime. He tweeted, "I was on board with this Tebow thing until I read he will miss multiple days per week in instructional league to do TV. No longer serious." And that is one thing that was apparently worked out. They covered this in the press conference today, that the Mets will allow him to leave instructional league 2 days a week to go and do his other job, which is SEC network analyst for college football. So he's going to miss at least a couple of days a week doing that. He'll work with the instructional league, with the team down there in whatever capacity is needed for the other days. But C.J. Nitkowski said if he's still trying to do his other job as an analyst and not be full in on baseball, all in, if you will, then this isn't serious. This is now a joke. There is some room for criticism there. As excited as I am about this development, I am also realistic and also honest, and that does really kind of rub some people the wrong way, and I can understand why. All right, we'll get a quick timeout here. We got a top of the hour Sports Center coming your way. Then we're going to come back and talk college football with Paul Keels, the voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Up the middle and through. Kipnis will score. Lindor's had a big turn,
And now he's almost caught in between, but he will go back to first base. Indians take the lead. Lindor sit. The 0-1. Lindor, a little number.
Slow shot. It'll be tough.
Bregman, bare hand grab. It doesn't come up with it. And the Indians are going to benefit for the second time on this homestand on an identical play. A shortstop goes for the bare hand grab, whiffs, and instead of giving up one, they give up two.
A relief for Rogers, but he has thrown a boatload of pitches.
Oh, Almonte down the line, headed for the corner. Ramirez scores. Here comes Lonnie right on his heels. And he'll score without a throw, and it's a two-run triple for Abraham Almonte and an 8-3 Cleveland lead.
The 1-1, swinging a line drive down the left field line toward the corner, and that is a fair ball. It'll be a ground rule double, RBI, two-out double for Iglesias, and the Tigers take a 4-3 lead in the seventh. Swinging a line drive, base hit up the right center field. Ganthet might tie the game. Abreu around second. He's being waved around third. Kinsler will not be able to relay to the plate. How about that?
Holy mackerel.
Double by Morneau, 4-4 game, 1-1. Swinging a ground ball up the middle and into center field, and the Sox will take the lead. The 1-2, check swing, went too far, and Collins strikes out. Tigers take the lead to the bottom of the eighth, but they cannot hang on, and the Sox take the series.
Great move by the New York Mets. They could obviously use some pop, a big bat. Tim Tebow swings a big bat. Is it a long shot that he would make it to the big leagues? It is a long shot, but I do give him a legit shot, just as the Mets are giving him a legit shot to start in the instructional league, go to winter ball, play double A, and just see if he could settle in, get more comfortable with the speed of the game that he has not played since he was a junior in high school. I believe he can become a serviceable left fielder for the New York Mets.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Hour number two underway. All of the above we covered and touched upon in hour number one. A little baseball, Indians and Tiger style. Tim Tebow going to the New York Mets. It's an outstanding opportunity. I love the story. Now it's time for more college football right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We welcome Paul Keels back to our program. Paul is, of course, the play-by-play voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. Paul, good afternoon. How are you, good sir?
I'm doing very good, Bob. How are you doing?
I'm great, man. Football is back in full force. We've had 2 weeks of high school action. We've had the college season lifted off already, and now we've got the NFL starting up tonight and then, of course, on Sunday. So life is good for those of us in the football world. Paul, let's get right into it. And I know it's been a few days now, obviously, but before we look ahead to week number two, let's talk a little bit more about what happened in week number one. Quite obviously an overmatched Bowling Green Falcons team there, but my oh my, were the Buckeyes impressive. JT Barrett kind of looked like what everybody thought Deshaun Watson was going to look like at the outset of the season, the odds-on Heisman favorite. JT Barrett went out there putting up school records left and right.
Well, he just looked comfortable, and I think this is kind of what everybody envisioned with him being the clear starting quarterback, and what you kind of had hoped had been there last year. But, you know, the thing JT did was he spread the ball around, took advantage of everybody else that kind of got on a roll, whether it was Mike Weber or Curtis Samuel or Dontre Wilson, hitting the different pass receivers and showing what he could do running the football himself. And, you know, minus that pick six he threw very early in the football game, it was really a monstrous performance from JT Barrett.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And now, do you really think that the unquestioned quarterback status affects him that much? In other words, you know, last year was a very strange situation, as we all know. As we came into camp, you know, in the spring, the question was, you know, is it going to be JT or Cardale? Of course, JT couldn't go, so Cardale had all the reps, and we went all through this thing throughout the summer and into the season. Does the fact that this is his football team now, as much as it's always going to be Urban Meyer's football team, it's JT Barrett's football team, does that really, you know, have that much of an impact on his confidence and on his ability to perform like that with, you know, without any of that stuff weighing on his mind?
I think it has a lot to do with it, but I think, Bob, we also have to factor in experience, confidence, the fact that, you know, he's been through this drill before. You know, a lot of people forget he had a redshirt year where he sat behind Braxton Miller, obviously didn't get on the field, sat behind Kenny Guyton, and was able to absorb what was going on out there. So I think it's a combination of those things, and you know, he's operating in an offense that's very similar from what we're told, what he did in high school. So, you know, it's a little, you know, boat in the water type of thing. And, you know, it's just, I think it's a comfort factor and also a firm grasp on what he's got around him, whether it's running backs, receivers, and what he can get from the offensive line.
Paul, does a team that puts up 77 on an opponent in week number one really take a whole lot away from that game? In other words, you know, they needed to get first-time starters, their first-time starts, and that's certainly a good thing. But beyond that, do we know any more about the Buckeyes after they were able to do that to an opponent that is obviously inferior like that? No disrespect intended to our friends at Bowling Green, and obviously Urban's friends at Bowling Green where he used to coach, but do they take a whole lot away? Do they really know more about themselves after that win, or is that just kind of one of those, well, it is the way it is, and we've got to grow and figure out what we have, you know, this coming week against Tulsa?
Now, I think they did take a few things away, Bob. First off, what Curtis Samuel and Dontre Wilson did was kind of what they've shown in small doses prior to that game and what everybody's been expecting from those guys for as much as they've been around. I think you can take away the fact that it looks like, based on just one game, you have to remember that it's just one, is that they have a seemingly legitimate tailback in Mike Weber, a guy that seems to be very decisive hitting the hole and goes very much north and south. I think you can take away the fact that they have some playmakers at wide receiver with Noah Brown, with K.J. Smith, and some other guys, or K.J. Hill, excuse me, waiting for Corey Smith to get back into the role. Paris Campbell and Terry McLaurin are guys that, you know, I think certainly are chomping to get their opportunities also. We know that they will and did throw the football to the tight end. That position group had five catches. And I think on defense, we were able to take away from the fact that we know that Malik Hooker is deserving, again, based on one game, of some of the hype that we've heard from him, you know, about a safety who can step in and replace Von Bell and Tyvus Powell. I think we've seen that Marshawn Lattimore can be that corner that can work opposite of what Garyon Conley can do. And we can also take away that Raekwon McMillan is still an awfully solid middle linebacker.
And, you know, one negative that came away, of course, is the loss of Tracy Sprinkle for the season with that knee injury. And that's a personal sad thing for me because he's a hometown guy for me from my hometown. And obviously he had finally earned and worked his way into a starting spot on that defensive line. That's a loss, like I said, on a personal level. But from a Buckeye level, that's a pretty good player who was really starting to kind of find it.
From what people who go to practice say, Bob, he was a guy that this summer really was kind of coming into his own. And, you know, it hopefully the opportunity will be there for others to take advantage, whether it's Devon Hamilton, Draymond Jones, Josh Allaby, Malik Barrow, Robert Landers. You know, those are the guys that play the inside positions that are going to get the next turns up. And hopefully there'll be guys that can help fill that bill. Remember, they lost also Darius Slade before the season started. So, you know, there's two guys that you know, in July, you figured were going to be part of the whole deal. But hopefully there's others that will step up and help fill that bill. But it is a shame. That's, you know, you see these coaches and, you know, as fans, you look at it in one aspect, but you really see how it affects the coaches, and that really tells you how significant, not only the loss of a player, but the loss of somebody who's worked hard to get to where they were, how that really affects these coaches.
Very well said. We're talking to Paul Keels. He says many things well. That's why he's the play-by-play voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. As we look back at week number one and look ahead, you know, it would be impolite to skip over a team, and you certainly don't want to do that, but I'd really like to ask you about Oklahoma. So in order to kind of keep with proper protocol, let's talk about Tulsa for a second. Although they are in Oklahoma, so there you go. I guess we can find a way to merge these things together. But what do you think that Urban Meyer is doing this week to prepare for this Tulsa team and make sure that the players are also focused on this Tulsa team? Oklahoma, as in the Sooners, as we know, upset victims in week number one. That is still a very, very dangerous proposition going to Norman in week number three. So will it be difficult for young guys, particularly a lot of new starters, as we talked about, to focus themselves on the Golden Hurricanes before they get to worrying about the Sooners?
Don't think so, Bob. And I think the fact that you look at, you know, Tulsa had a decisive win in week one and really came out of the gate fast offensively, just like Ohio State did. Tulsa boasts a couple of receivers that people are saying are NFL caliber type players, and Keevan Lucas and Justin Hobbs, a record setting quarterback in Dane Evans, who could be the all time leading passer in Tulsa history by this time he's done. Now, I know that doesn't make people quake in their boots, but also, while Tulsa is known for throwing the football, they've got three tailbacks that that seemingly it can make major contributions and an offensive line, from the size standpoint, that really gets the coach's attention when they just, you know, you talk about looking at a MAC team or a Conference USA team, and usually the dimensions differ, but they seem to think that the physical makeup of Tulsa's offensive line compares to a Big Ten team. You know, defensively, they were able to get a defensive TD last week. They got a TD off of special teams on a fumble recovery and a muff punt return. And, you know, Tulsa's a program that, you know, whether you want to compare them to some of the MAC schools here, if you want to compare them to schools in other places, but they've had to live in the shadow of the powers in their state. But they've been able to go, and you have to go back a ways, but they've been able to go pull upsets. And, you know, I think the highest upset they have is beating number 7 Arkansas back in the 70s. You know, they've been able to get great athletes and players that have gone on and made significant contributions in the NFL. But I know what you're getting at. It's kind of that game before the one that everybody's looking for. Yep. I always remember how people, I forget exactly the year, but Ohio State was going to play USC. And the week before, they were playing Ohio University, and everybody wanted to just skip talking about the Bobcats. And I think that game was tied close to halftime or something like that. So, you know, we all know that when you skip over somebody, sometimes that's where it ends up being a tighter game than people expect.
Yeah, and there's no doubt, you know, you talk about Tulsa's history of having, you know, upset some teams, but maybe the Buckeyes don't need to look there. They need to just look around the country last week at all of the top 10 or top 15 ranked schools. You know, even though the rankings mean absolutely nothing right now except for conversation and talk radio like this. But you had top 15 teams losing to unranked teams. You had a Tennessee team nearly lose at home at Rocky Top to an App State team. They barely beat in overtime. So, you know, you look at what are some of those things that have happened to teams that are supposed, including Oklahoma, as we know. Not that Houston is some sort of an upstart. Houston is a very, very good football team that a lot of people might might look at as a possible playoff team, but you know, you have to stay focused because they've seen what happened to teams that did not stay focused in week one.
Well, I think if you look at what's happened in Urban Meyer's time at Ohio State, you know, they've not lost a game they shouldn't have lost, meaning they haven't had one of those bad non-conference games or a loss to a Big Ten team that hasn't had a winning record. And that happens to seemingly everybody. I mean, what was it? Hell, a few years ago, Alabama got jumped at home by somebody they shouldn't have lost to. But Ohio State's been able to avoid that. And, you know how coaches are. They find the things to preach. They find their phrases. They find their sayings, whatever it is. And I think the thing that helps in week two, despite the fact that the margin was what it was last week against Bowling Green, this coaching staff is still preaching on how they need to get better. And I'm sure every other coach going into week two that's coming off a win, regardless of what it's like, is doing the same thing. And maybe they know that, you know, they're going to have to improve on some things and get a little mindful. If they don't do this better or that better, they won't win in Norman. They won't win in State College. They won't win in Madison. But, you know, I think they also understand. And the, you know, these players now with social media and everything else, they're so much more in tune to things than they were 10, 15 years ago. They understand that, you know, this is a program maker for Tulsa, and this Ohio State team does not want to be on the business end of that should it happen.
Paul Keel's our guest. He is the play-by-play voice of the Ohio State Buckeyes. Of course, you hear him right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket, whenever the Buckeyes play. Paul, let me ask you for some superlatives from week number one. The best performance that you saw, was it number one Alabama? Was it the Buckeyes? Michigan opened up very, very strong against an overmatched Hawaii team, of course. Maybe it's Houston, who, of course, knocked out a number three. Oklahoma. So a lot of really great things that we saw. Comeback victories by Florida State. That was an incredible win over Ole Miss. So what impressed you the most, do you think, from week one, Paul?
I'm going to start with Florida State because that was one I almost gave up on at halftime, Bob. You know, for a young quarterback, redshirt freshman quarterback for the Seminoles, who seemed to be struggling for much of the first half, and they put some things together. And so very impressed with what Florida State did. Another thing that jumps out at me is Texas. You know, that's a game that Texas probably needed more than Notre Dame needed. And it certainly seemed when Notre Dame got the block PAT and returned it for 2 points, they had all the momentum going their way. But to see Texas win that game the way they did and see, you know, knowing just the scrutiny that Charlie Strong has been under, and I think we've all known that Charlie Strong's a good football coach. He walked into a real storm there in Texas, and to see the emotional release out of that was really something. And I also, and maybe it will hold more value down the road, Bob, Wisconsin's win over LSU. because I think most people figured that was a game that Wisconsin might make it close. But realistically, did we think they'd beat LSU? And let's also, and maybe you've thought about this too, how about give LSU a little credit? I don't think there's many SEC teams that are going to go north of the Mason-Dixon line to play somebody in the Big Ten, the Big 12, or whatever. So let's give LSU a little credit for putting himself in a position that they're now probably getting a lot of scrutiny for.
Yeah, and what is in essence a home game for Wisconsin, of course, there at Lambeau. I mean, the entire state of Wisconsin was there for that and extraordinarily excited for that showdown. Last thing on this, and then and we really appreciate your time, Paul. When you see a Texas, because you singled them out, get that win against Notre Dame the way that they did, I gripe about these things. It's what I do. I mean, I do talk radio, so I complain a lot. nothing against Texas or Charlie Strong. He is a great story. It is a great story. No question about that. But how can you be 1 week not among the top 25 teams in the country, not even considered one of the top 25 teams, win a game in double overtime that you really almost had no business winning, but you barely won anyway, and suddenly now you're the 11th best team in the country? The rankings just seem to make no sense. You go from unranked to now, hey, we're the 11th best team in America because we barely didn't lose to Notre Dame in double overtime.
Well, and Wisconsin, too, who moved to number 10.
And Wisconsin, being in the poll.
It shows you some of what is laughable about the polls. It's ammunition for all of us in our business to talk about it. But I think we all know that you can pick it apart this week. But during the course of a whole season, that'll separate itself. If Texas truly is a team that should be in the top 10 or around the top 10, they'll have the rest of the season to prove it. The same with Wisconsin. For those that fell out, they have the rest of the season to try to play themselves back into it. So I think that's, the poll is positioning, the poll is conversation. We kind of know that really once you get into mid to late October, that's where the polls become so important, but mostly just at the top. I mean, if you find yourself really going into the last couple of weeks angling just to get into the top 10, then most likely you're not going to be in the discussion for the playoff when the season comes to an end. But it is laughable that you can go from being out to being 10 and 11, or you can go from being, wherever some of them were and go completely out of it.
Yeah, and I guess the reason I bring it up, and you're right, these early polls don't really matter, but we talked about it extensively yesterday on our show, Paul, about how hard it is to climb, usually, unless you have this massive leap that Texas and Wisconsin just took, but when you're ranked low and you deserve to be higher, you've got to start at a lower spot rather than if the first ranking comes out, say, in the first Monday in October, after everybody has been seen playing four times, you don't have to climb as high in order to be on the radar of the committee that selects the playoff teams. And conversely, a team like Tennessee, who was ninth, who nearly lost in overtime at home against App State, only falls down to where did they land, 16 or 17?
Something like that, yes.
Yeah, to me, which is just crazy. There is no way this team that I saw play against Appalachian State is one of the top 25, let alone the top 17 teams in the country. There has to be a bigger punishment for a loss like that where you've got to fall deeper. If we're going to rank now, I guess my point is I want them to be accurate rankings and not just, hey, this team, we launch 18 spots higher and this one only dropped 8 lower for getting a very, very weak win. I guess that's the biggest complaint I have is when the polls do start to matter in late October, teams still might not be where they belong because they started off in a place that was so abjectly wrong, if that's the right word.
Well, and a lot of it involves guesswork before the season starts. That's the even trickier element to it, I think, Bob, is because you're making guesses before a first game is played on where somebody should be.
Exactly.
And then the result of what happens to them from their first game, win or lose, is affected by where they were placed in the first place. And, and Tennessee is a great example that, let's say Tennessee goes on a major successful run and they're tearing everything else and they haven't lost a game in November. We're probably not really thinking about the App State game as much in the same way then as we are right now. So, they can feel lukewarm about winning a football game like that.
That they want because of all of the pomp and circumstance that surrounds raising your banner as the new Super Bowl champions and all the momentum that goes along with that. But I think Carolina is that good, and I think Cam Newton can have that kind of a season again. Am I saying he will be the MVP? No. But I think he's going to build on it. It wasn't a one-hit wonder. It is there are a lot of talented quarterbacks in his division. He's going to have to be on his game 6 games a year to play Drew Brees twice and try to beat him, to play Matt Ryan twice and try to beat him. And Jameis Winston, who had a 4,000-yard rookie season, is only going to be better and better. And so Cam is going to have to play those kinds of games. And I think the Panthers, as I, you know, just kind of consider the NFC as a whole, I think the Panthers are better than the Seahawks. The Seahawks are certainly the you know, right there with the Cardinals, the class of the West. They'll probably both make the playoffs, as you pointed out earlier on, Jim, but I don't think either one of them is going to the bowl over the Panthers. I think they have. They get started tonight with the quest of unfinished business. And they were in that game last year in that Super Bowl with an opportunity to win it, and they did not finish their business. And I see the Panthers going back.
Yeah, and right now I kind of lean a little bit towards them in the NFC. I feel that Arizona, and by the way, a side note, what a world we're living in when you legitimately can say that the Cardinals are a good team once again. And it's we've been able to say that for a couple years now.
Very good
it's just strange. Yeah, it's still strange to me. This is the Cardinals franchise we're talking about. Anyway.
Yeah, but Bruce Arians is not the Cardinals franchise, you know, historically their type of coach. He has
True.
Built something there.
Yes.
And he's got a quarterback, of course, the resurgent Carson Palmer, who is not a spring chicken anymore, but is not washed up either, and he can still put up huge numbers. In fact, had some MVP type games and a lot of votes or consideration anyway at the end of the season. Look, that's a very, and they got one of the best secondaries with two of the best cover guys in football in Peterson and Matthew, both signed to long-term deals. I think that is a very, very dangerous team. And when I said nobody's going to the bowl out of the West, I'll probably give my, you know, if I'm wrong, I'll probably be willing to say that it's Arizona more than it is Seattle. And this might be my anti-Seahawk bias coming through. I don't know. I haven't really dug the recesses into the recesses of my soul yet to find out if that's what it is. But I do like Arizona, just not quite as much as I like Carolina in the NFC.
And I can easily see that argument. I really can. I'm just simply saying, if anything, I think Arizona is one of the chief competitors out there in the NFC. Seattle's, I actually like Arizona over Seattle right now in that West, because I think at this moment, Arizona's more of a little bit of a complete team. But I don't know. I still think Carolina can definitely be the favorite. If nothing else, I would not be shocked if we see a Panthers-Cardinals NFC championship game.
I wouldn't either. I would not either. I really, like I said, I don't see anybody in the NFC East being better than either of them. And I don't know why, but I'm not sold on Green Bay. A lot of people are, and I'm not. And I'm going to tell you why. Believe it or not, it's because of the best quarterback in the game that almost everybody agrees. Unless you think it is the defending champion, you know, defending MVP Cam Newton, most people think the best quarterbacks in the game are Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady, Ben Roethlisberger, and Andrew Luck, probably in some order, but usually with Rodgers at the top. It's because of him that I'm not sold. As great as he is, and as great as he has been, and as otherworldly as his talent is, he has not always performed in the playoffs. He's very, very Peyton Manning-esque in that regard. And a regular season beast with numbers that you just cannot even really process. But then in the playoffs, it doesn't always seem to go his way. For whatever reason, he's got the one bowl and that's it. And I just, you know, if it comes down to, you know, a game in January for a chance to go to the Super Bowl or even just to advance to a conference championship game, I don't know why, but I look at the Packers and I see a team that's ready to fold. I don't see that when I see Palmer in the Cardinals for whatever reason. And I don't see that with the Carolina Panthers either. After, like I said, they got so close to tasting that thing last year. They could smell it in the air right before they could take a bite of that championship. It was yanked away from them. They have unfinished business. I just think that in a playoff run, I don't think the Packers get there. I don't think the Giants or the Redskins or anybody else. I think the Cowboys are going to be miserable. I think the Eagles are going to be miserable with Carson Wentz. The Niners suck. The LA Rams are going to suck. Who did I say? Carolina, of course, in the South. I don't think anybody else is coming out of there. I don't know. I think it's a pretty fairly, in my mind, fairly easy call that it's Carolina. The best teams in the NFC are Carolina, Arizona, and Seattle. All right, let's go to the AFC just briefly. And I said I wasn't going to do all these divisions, but here we are. We just kind of get off on a roll, and here we go. First of all, I love the way the standings look today. You want to know why?
Because the Browns aren't in last place
because
by themselves?
The Browns are in second place. Because when there are no games played yet, they just list the teams in alphabetical order. And they're Cincinnati, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, and Baltimore.
That's true. They would be second. I was just saying not last.
Wait. Why are they listed like that's not alphabetical? Baltimore would be first.
I don't know. Either way, they're not actually last place by themselves.
No,
that's coming
not.
Soon.
I'm very serious about this, though. I thought they were second just because they did the alphabetical thing, and then I realized not. They are in the West, Denver, Kansas City, Oakland, San Diego. In the South, let's see. No, they're not there either. Tennessee, Indianapolis, Jacksonville, Houston. What rhyme or reason, I wonder, do they give for putting these teams in the way that they have? That's trippy. I want somebody to
tell me. You got me on that one. I have no idea.
These are the ESPN standings. These are the ESPN standings. ESPN.com standings. I'm curious. Hold on. Just for the sake of checking it, I want to check NFL.com standings and see how they put the teams, what order they put them in when they haven't played. Now, this isn't alphabetical either because they do have Baltimore first, but then they go to Pittsburgh, then Cleveland, then Cincinnati. There's no rhyme or reason to it. Buffalo, New York, New England, Miami. Okay, neither one of those makes sense either. I'm just curious as to how it is. Is it just computer-generated random? That's just all kind of weird. Anyway, into the AFC we go. The Browns open the season. We'll do a preview on the Browns tomorrow with Petrak like we did with the Lions and Rodgers today. The Browns will open up against a very bad Philadelphia Eagles team. Jim Cushlin, they are in no way, shape, or form going to win that division. Who do you like in the North?
In the North right now, I kind of like Pittsburgh. I mean, I still don't understand, to be honest with you, how the Bengals keep being as good as they have been in recent years. I'm serious. I mean, I'm not saying they have a bad roster or anything. Far from it, but they just keep surprising me regularly. Of course, they fall on their face the minute the playoffs start. So I like Pittsburgh right now. Baltimore's to me the X factor. I don't think they'll be as bad as last year, but I question if we're suddenly going to see 11-5 Ravens teams again.
Yeah, no, I think the Ravens are going to be the third place team here. I do. I think they are in a bad way. I think the Browns are going to be awful. They may win 3 or 4 games, and that's it. I think their roster is terrible. I'm not saying they're tanking. The Ravens are not a whole lot better, though. It is definitely a Steelers-Bengals division, and I think the Steelers are just the more professional organization. And when it comes down to it, somebody in a Bengals uniform will do something stupid again, whether it's Pac-Man or whether it's Vontaze Burfict or Marvin Lewis, for all I know. The Steelers are going to win that division. AFC East is an interesting development there because of the Tom Brady suspension. If he's healthy, then it's just the way, for 16 games, it's just the way that it goes. He's not suspended. It's New England, and then everybody's fighting for the next scraps. He's not. He's going to miss 4 games. How will Jimmy Garoppolo do? Will he put them in a hole that they can't climb out of? Only time will tell. But outside of the Patriots, the only team that I really like to have improved a lot in that division is the New York Jets.
Yeah, the Jets feel like they've improved a little bit, although until further notice, nobody's knocking off the Patriots in that division. They just
aren't.
Well,
nobody again, and again, unless Garoppolo is just falls flat on his face and they start out 1-3 or God forbid 0-4. I don't think they will. My point is, I still think they'll win the division, but I think the New York Jets are going to be there with them neck and neck all season. I think the Bills are going to be terrible under the Ryan brothers, and I think Miami is extraordinarily overrated as well.
I could buy that. I buy that argument. Totally.
So I think that's definitely Patriots. In the AFC South, I'm not a fan of the division. It's just a crappy division. I think the Titans are still going to stink. I think the Jaguars are still going to stink. I think the Colts are a toss-up because Andrew Luck, can't stay healthy behind that sieve of a line. And the Houston Texans, they won the division last year by default, threw 5 interceptions from Brian Hoyer in the playoffs and signed Brock Osweiler, who hasn't earned squat, to a $70-plus million contract. So I don't know what to make out of that division. I guess just because nobody else has Andrew Luck, we'll say the Colts and Andrew Luck. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm going to buy that right now. Colts with Andrew Luck. You can have all the J.J. Watts on your team that you want in terms of the Houston Texans, but if you've got an iffy quarterback situation, I'll take the team that has a real quarterback. Thank you.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And then in the AFC West, the trendy, sexy thing is that Oakland is rising. I'm not there yet. I think they have a lot of great young players. I think they have a lot of potential. They have a lot of momentum that they haven't had for a long time. They have been so bad for so long, really since, Rich Gannon threw those 5 interceptions in the Super Bowl back in 2002. They have just been awful. And I don't think they're there. They're a step away. They're a year away. This is still the Broncos division because of that defense we talked about. If Trevor Siemian doesn't just absolutely stink, the Broncos defense should be enough to carry them past Kansas City, San Diego, and Oakland. I just think Oakland is still a year away.
I'm in agreement with that. I think Oakland's probably still a year away, but it'll be interesting to see just how improved they are.
Yeah, no question about it. I think they are going to be improved, but just not enough to make the playoffs yet. Okay, I wanted to squeeze those in as much as possible here before I tell you about a couple of things before we sign out, and I do hear the music playing. First of all, we got a sweet deal for tomorrow morning that we don't want you to forget about. Real seafood. We're going to get to Zia's in Toledo, Real Seafood in Toledo, or Chow in Sylvania. Just log on to 106.5 The Ticket tomorrow. These are Main Street Ventures gift certificates. $50 for either Zia's in Toledo or Real Seafood in Toledo or Chow in Sylvania. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., the $50 sweet deal gift certificates are just $25 at any of the three restaurants. Or if you want one for $0, be our 10th caller on our way out the door here. Be caller number 10 right now to 866-240-1065, and we will hook you up with the $50 gift certificate for free. If you don't get the freebie tomorrow morning, get the half-price one online at 1065theticket.com. And that's all the time that we got today. Thanks so much for being a part of the program. We appreciated the conversation. And also Justin Rogers and Paul Keels for joining us as guests. Tomorrow, it's a free-for-all Friday. We'll update the baseball race. We will obviously do a little preview of the Browns since we did our Lions story with Justin Rogers today. So we'll get that on the air tomorrow as well. And it'll be free-for-all Friday. So until then, have a great night. Stay where you are, by the way, because Mike Miller and Drive Time coming up next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.